political philosophy. I hope you've read the chapter in Christian View of Men and Things on politics. It will be a big help to you as we go through the three lectures this evening in understanding what I'm going to say. In the first hour, I want to pose some of the major questions of political philosophy and give you some non-Christian answers to those questions. In the second hour, we'll continue with non-Christian answers to those questions, and in the third hour, we'll see what the Bible has to say about them. We begin with the questions themselves, and Clark discusses these in the chapter. The questions that concern political philosophy are such questions as, what government or what form of government is the best form of government? And if there are any anarchists in the audience, of course you will object immediately. Why do you think we need a government? So that's another good question. Is government necessary at all? Why do we have governments? To ask the question on a more profound level, why should one man obey another man? Why should one man obey another man? If we have government, what should government do? What are its legitimate and proper functions? How should we choose, or should we even choose, governors? Should they be hereditary monarchs? And we don't make a choice. The people, at least, don't make a choice as to who the governors are. Or should we elect them? It's these sorts of questions that concern political philosophy. And the answers to these questions fall into five major categories. The first is anarchism, and I'll be talking about that during the first hour, anarchism. These are folks who say there should be no government. Consequently, they would answer the questions like, what sort of government is best? Is there shouldn't be any government. It's a silly question. Why should one man obey another? He shouldn't. All men are equal. One man is not obligated to obey another. Is government necessary at all? No. What should government do? Nothing. Who should choose governors? No one. And that's a whole point of view in political philosophy. The second major answer is that the government or the state is a natural development. A natural development. This can be traced back to Plato and Aristotle, in particular Aristotle, and I will read to you from Aristotle's Politics this evening. It's also the view of the Roman Catholic Church. And this is the view, if I can draw an analogy that Aristotle might not be too uncomfortable with, individuals grow into states as acorns grow into oaks. It's natural. Individuals grow into states. They organize themselves into first households and then villages and then governments, societies, states, just as acorns grow when you plant them in the ground into oak trees. It's a natural thing. Aristotle has a teleological view of the state. He has a teleological view of practically everything, but especially the state this evening. The third major view is simply that the state is based on agreement, or government is based on agreement among men. This is the social contract view. The social contract, or the social compact, sometimes it's called. Sometimes this is called the conventional view. Government is based on agreement. The representatives of this school of thought are Hobbes, the Englishman who defended absolute monarchy. He was writing about the time, to give you the proper time frame, writing about the same time the Westminster Assembly was meeting in London, writing the Westminster Confession of Faith. John Locke, someone more relevant to American government, he was writing at the end of the 17th century instead of the middle of the 17th century. Both Englishmen. Jean-Jacques Rousseau is the political philosopher that Clark discusses in particular in that chapter on politics, a Frenchman, writing after both Hobbes and Locke. He's writing in the 18th century. And those are the three major figures in the social contract view. Clark mentions another view called, in which it was, I guess the best way of putting it is the view that the nature of the state is just power. And he cites Oswald Spengler as a proponent of this view. He also cites a justice of the Supreme Court, Oliver Wendell Holmes. And I'll be calling your attention to some quotes from Holmes before we finish with that point of view. And then finally, the fifth view is the Christian view, that government is by divine ordination or divine right. It's not a natural growth. It's not based on consent or agreement. It's not based on power. Christians are not anarchists, but the state is ordained by God. Government is ordained by God. So let's get into this by talking about anarchism first. There's, as you might imagine, a whole variety of anarchists. Most of them are collectivists. In the 19th century, all of them are. In 20th century America, you have something rare appearing in anarchist circles, and that is a capitalist rather than a collectivist anarchist. Murray Rothbard, perhaps you've heard the name Murray Rothbard, the economist. He is or was an anarchist. David Friedman, the son of the Milton Friedman, the famous Nobel Prize-winning economist, David Friedman, is a capitalist anarchist. They believe that there should be no government. And if you read books by them, you can read their arguments as to why there shouldn't be a government. But most of the anarchists, and most of them are confined to the 19th century, are collectivists. They are not in favor of capitalism at all. The word itself, anarchy or anarchism, is based on two Greek words meaning without a ruler, anarchos, without a ruler. Most of them are atheists. That goes for Murray Rothbard and David Friedman, too. Many of them are romantics, not all of them, but they're romantics. That is, they have this vision of the world, and they have a rosy view of human nature. And human nature is not inherently sinful, but if we liberate men from government, all their goodness will come out and everything will be fine and dandy. The book I'd recommend is a standard work. If you're interested in reading more about anarchism, it's simply called Anarchism. History of Libertarian Ideas and Movements is the subtitle, by George Woodcock. And he has chapters in here on the major figures in the movement in the 19th century and then a discussion of the movement itself in the 19th century. Let's begin with looking at the first and probably the most radical of them all, a German named Max Stirner, S-T-I-R-N-E-R, Max Stirner. He wrote a book called The Ego and His Own. The Ego and His Own. Now, Stirner was, when I say the most radical, he was a nihilist. He thought society ought to be destroyed. Not just government, but all of society ought to be destroyed. Nietzsche, in fact, who many people think of as a nihilist, was positively a middle of the roader compared to Max Stirner. Max Stirner made him look like a moderate. Nietzsche had a high regard for Max Stirner. He found the source of some of his ideas in Stirner's writings. Stirner glorified the use of force. He was very anti-intellectual. He regarded that as sort of a feminine characteristic. If you rely on the intellect, that's effeminate. You have to rely on the will and the instinct. That's real anarchism. He's an atheist, but more than that, he's an anti-theist. And I think I want to explain what the difference is between the two. People can be an atheist without being militant about it. He was very militant about it. He was an anti-theist. He hated the idea of God. And he might be called something beyond an atheist, an anti-theist. Let me give you a quote from Stirner, just to give you a flavor of his thinking from his book, The Ego and His Own. He says, "I do not demand any right, therefore I need not recognize any either. What I can get by force, I get by force. And what I do not get by force, I have no right to, nor do I give myself airs or consolation with talk of my imprescriptible right. Entitled or unentitled, that does not concern me. If I am only powerful, I am empowered of myself and need no other empowering or entitling." This is a man who's shaking his fist at the universe. And what he's going to get by force. Right and wrong have no meaning to him. The right to property, the right to life has no meaning to him. He's simply going to take what he wants by force. It's an irrational point of view, anti-intellectual and irrational point of view. In some ways, he's sort of a precursor to existentialism in the 20th century. Again, you have this irrationalism that's at the basis of this point of view. I'm not saying the existentialists go out and say, take things by force, as Max Stirner did, but they glorify this irrational individual. And this irrational individual relies on his will and his instincts to get what he wants. Well, then we have the Frenchman, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, who is also an anarchist. He wrote a book called What is Property? He wrote several books. And in that book, What is Property?, he answers the question. And let me read his answer to you. Here, if you'll give me a second, I'll find it. Let's see here. This is Proudhon, Proudhon, if you don't know how to spell it, Proudhon, like proud Hun. This is what he wrote. He says, "If I were asked to answer the question, what is slavery, I should answer in one word, murder. My meaning would be understood at once. No further argument would be needed to show that the power to take from a man his thought, his will, his personality is a power of life and death, and that to enslave a man is to kill him. Why then, to this other question, what is property, may I not likewise answer theft? Property is theft, according to Proudhon." Now, of course, this analogy he draws is faulty in more than one way. But the notion that property is theft is, of course, nonsense. For a very simple reason. For you to have the concept of theft, you have to have the concept of rightfully owned property. So to say property is theft is to talk nonsense. It's like saying squares are round. There has to be a concept of rightfully owned property for there to be a concept of theft. If there were no rightfully owned property, there could be no theft. You could take things and it would not be stealing if no one rightfully owned anything. He wrote several other books. He's very anti-capitalist, as you might gather from that statement, property is theft. I'll give you a couple of other quotes from him. Many of these fellows, by the way, had some background in theology, Proudhon among them, and they were offended, in Proudhon's case here, by the defense of Christianity offered by clergymen. Let me see here. He talks about the people. The people is an important concept in both communism and anarchism. He defines the people as a collective, an infallible and divine being, as he calls it when he's not dismissing it as an ignorant rabble. But this notion that the people, as a collective group, is an infallible and divine being is very important in this strain of thought. It's the people that is the basis of society, and it's the people that substitute for government, and we have no need for government. Continuing here with Proudhon, let me see if I can find that quote I'm looking for. Here's the statement I was looking for. Proudhon himself slowly converted to atheism by the ineptitude of the defense of Christianity by clergymen. He also absorbed much genuine religious scholarship, taught himself Hebrew in his spare time, and encountered one of the men who later helped to shape his social theories, Charles Fourier, another Frenchman. But many of these folks come out of some sort of religious background, and they react to an inept defense of Christianity. That, of course, is one of the problems with an inept defense of Christianity. Someone once said, the worst thing that can befall any movement or any idea is not to be aggressively attacked, but to be ineptly defended. Because it's the inept defense that leads people to believe that there's nothing there. There's nothing worthwhile paying attention to. There's nothing worthwhile believing. And that was certainly the case in Proudhon's life. Leaving France, we turn to Russia. Michael Bakunin, B-A-K-U-N-I-N. Michael Bakunin. He was an aristocrat. This is another curious thing. You find sometimes an alliance between the nobility and the aristocrats with the what they call the proletariat, the workers, against the bourgeois, the capitalist, the middle class. That's what happens in the 19th century. Bakunin is an aristocrat. He didn't leave any completed book. He rarely completed anything. Never held a job in his life, lived off the generosity of friends, was continually getting loans and gifts from his friends. Not that he was greedy or anything. He gave away the stuff as fast as he got it, but led sort of the perpetual life of a hippie in the 19th century. He wrote several essays and pamphlets and that sort of thing. Let me read you a couple quotes from Bakunin here to give you a sort of flavor for his thinking. This is what he thinks that's going to end society as he knows it, which is a good thing in his idea, in his mind. He says, there will be a qualitative transformation, a new living, life-giving revelation, a new heaven and a new earth, a young and mighty world in which all our present dissonances will be resolved into a harmonious whole. He says, let us put our trust in the eternal spirit which destroys and annihilates only because it is the unsearchable and eternally creative source of all life. The urge to destroy is also a creative urge. So you have here a movement that glorifies destruction. The urge to destroy is a creative urge. And if we destroy society, there is going to be this transformation and a new heaven and a new earth will emerge. Now, what they're doing, essentially, the anarchists of the 19th century, is they're taking a Christian eschatology and trying to achieve it by their own efforts. Very dangerous situation. Let me give you another quote from Bakunin. He develops the idea that property ought to be owned in common. He says this is true. Every man who comes into the world, he says here, says to organize society in such a fashion that every individual, man or woman, coming into life shall find as nearly as possible equal means for the development of his or her different faculties and for the utilization of his or her labor. Common property. There's no private property. The world is meant for us in common, and everybody has the right to use it in that fashion. He penned also a little catechism called the Revolutionary Catechism, in which he said this: the revolutionary is a man now under vow, He ought to occupy himself entirely with one exclusive interest, with one thought and one passion, the revolution. He has only one aim, one science, destruction. Between him and society, there is a war to the death, incessant, irreconcilable. He must make a list of those who are condemned to death and expedite their sentence according to the order of their relative iniquities. There's an enemies list for you. He must make a list of those who are condemned to death and expedite their sentence according to the order of their relative iniquities. Anarchists did, in fact, in the 19th century, assassinate presidents, prime ministers, kings. They took their ideas very seriously and acted on them. Peter Kropotkin, another Russian, a little bit younger than Bakunin, he was an hereditary prince in Russia. He wrote a book called Mutual Aid. He was much less flamboyant than Bakunin. People that met him said he was saintly. He was a saintly figure. And nevertheless, he expresses many of the same ideas. He was not of the personality type that would go out and blow up something. Although many of the anarchists did, that was not Kropotkin's style, but he endorsed the ideas. Perhaps the most famous of these men is one you've heard of, Leo Tolstoy. The novelist, the Russian novelist, War and Peace, is his most famous novel. He took the title from Proudhon. Proudhon wrote a book called War and Peace. And he very much was a fan of the Frenchman Proudhon. He did not call himself an anarchist, but I'll give you a quote from him. He says, "All governments are in equal measure good and evil. The best ideal is anarchy." So while he did not call himself an anarchist, he did say the best ideal is anarchy. No government at all. He called himself a literal Christian. He fancied that he was a literal Christian. A couple more quotes from Leo Tolstoy. He says, "The modern state is nothing but a conspiracy to exploit, but most of all to demoralize its citizens. He says, I shall henceforth never serve any government elsewhere. He says, I regard all governments, not only the Russian government, as intricate institutions sanctified by tradition and custom for the purpose of committing by force and with impunity the most revolting crimes. And I think that the efforts of those who wish to improve our social life should be directed toward the liberation of themselves from national governments, whose evil, and above all, whose futility, is in our time becoming more and more apparent." Very much opposed to the idea of government, and perhaps their most influential spokesman. The fact that he could speak out even against the Tsarist government in Russia at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century undermined the moral authority of the Tsarist government. The anarchists in Russia, but in the meantime, of course, were waging war against the Tsarist government. And it's the anarchists and the communists the Bolsheviks, who initially are fighting on the same side, and then the Bolsheviks wipe out the anarchists because they're even more ruthless in the use of force than the anarchists are, and they come to power in 1917. Leo Tolstoy had an equally famous disciple nearer our time, Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi learned a lot of his ideas from Leo Tolstoy. Now, this is one major school of thought in the history of political philosophy. The anarchists, they advocate destruction, lawlessness. They think that out of destruction something good is going to emerge, but what is sure to emerge is violence, death, and lawlessness. I don't know that they learned any lessons after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917 or not. Perhaps they did. So much for that point of view. Yes, sir? Yes. Yes, it does. They were influenced by the gentleman we'll speak about in a few minutes or in the second hour, Rousseau. There is some similarity there. But before we get to Rousseau, I want to talk about Aristotle. And I'll recommend this book, Aristotle, The Politics, translated by a fellow named Lord, Carnes Lord. This is Aristotle's principal work on political philosophy. And I want to take it rather slow because it's been so influential. I mean, not that the anarchists haven't, but this is the point of view of many people, not just those within the Roman Catholic Church. This is the point of view of the Roman Church as well. But many people down through history have been tremendously influenced by Aristotle's view of the state. Now, let me begin by looking at chapter one of the Politics here. Aristotle, keep in mind, wrote in Greece in the 4th century before Christ. This is how he begins. Since we see that every city is some sort of partnership. Now, the Greek word there for partnership is koinonia, the same word that we translate as fellowship in the Bible. Same word. It says, we see that every city is some sort of partnership, and that every partnership is constituted for the sake of some good, for everyone does everything for the sake of what is held to be good. It is clear that all partnerships aim at some good, and that the partnership that is most authoritative of all and embraces all the others does so particularly and aims at the most authoritative good of all. This is what is called the city, or political partnership. Now, let's back up a little and look more closely at this opening sentence of the Politics. He says that every partnership is constituted for some good. And he's going to talk about several different types of partnership, and we'll get to that in a moment. The partnership of marriage, that's one form of partnership or fellowship. It's constituted, it's established for some good. There's also a partnership between parents and children. There's a partnership between masters and slaves. And finally, there's the political partnership, where families associate into villages and then villages into states. And he says here in this one first sentence in the Politics, he says, all partnerships aim at some good. They have some purpose. They aim at some good that they want to achieve. The partnership that is most authoritative of all, the one of the highest authority, the one that embraces all the others, is the political partnership. It aims at the highest good, the most authoritative good, and it's the political partnership. This is the basis for what we know in the 20th century, what we call in the 20th century fascism. The motto of Mussolini's fascism in Italy in the 1920s and 30s and 40s was everything within the state, nothing outside the state. Everything within the state, nothing outside the state. Mussolini was echoing Aristotle. The highest partnership of all, the most authoritative partnership, is the political partnership, the state. Well, skipping to chapter 2 of the Politics here, he says, in these matters as elsewhere, it is by looking at how things develop naturally from the beginning that one may best study them. First, then, there must of necessity be a conjunction of persons who cannot exist without one another, on the one hand, male and female, he's talking about marriage now, for the sake of reproduction. This is the good at which marriage is aimed, the partnership of marriage, which occurs not from intentional choice. Marriage does not occur from intentional choice, but as is the case with the other animals and plants, and notice the word other, from a natural striving to leave behind another that is like oneself. That is his explanation for procreation. It's a natural striving to leave behind another that is like oneself. On the other hand, now that's one partnership, the marriage partnership. It says, on the other, the naturally ruling and ruled. This is another sort of partnership. On account of preservation, for that which can foresee with the mind is the naturally ruling and naturally mastering element, and those who have a body only are those who are naturally ruled or slaves. And so on and so forth. We'll get into slavery in a little bit. From these two partnerships, then the household first arose. The whole household then is made of the partnership between male and female, the marriage partnership, and the ruling and the ruled. First a house and a woman and an ox for plowing, for poor persons have oxen instead of servants, or instead of slaves. The household is the partnership constituted by nature for the needs of daily life. That's the purpose of the household. The purpose of marriage is procreation, leaving some little fellow around that looks like you. That's the purpose of marriage. The purpose of the household is to meet the needs of daily life. The first partnership arising from the union of several households is for the sake of the non-daily needs, the occasional needs. That's the village. So we move now from marriage to household to village. Each partnership becomes more and more inclusive. By nature, the village seems to be above all an extension of the household. And he says, in early villages, they were all ruled by kings because households are ruled by kings. The eldest in the household rules. Then continuing, he says, the partnership arising from the union of several villages, this is the complete partnership, is the city. It reaches a level of full self-sufficiency, and while coming into being for the sake of living, it exists for the sake of living well. And see, the purposes of the partnerships, as we move up this hierarchy of partnerships, marriage is for the purpose of procreation. The household partnership is for the purpose of meeting the needs of daily living. The village partnership is for the purpose of meeting occasional needs for living. And then the city is the fully self-sufficient level. It's needed, its purpose is living well, not just living, meeting the needs, but living well. He concludes, every city, therefore, exists by nature. For the city is the end of all these other partnerships, and nature is the end of things. The city belongs among the things that exist by nature. The city is not unnatural. The city is not conventional. It's not just force. It's natural. And man is by nature a political animal. That's one of the most famous lines from Aristotle's Politics. Man is by nature a political animal. Then he continues, and he draws out some of the implications of the argument that he's just presented here about this hierarchy of partnerships, the highest of which is the political partnership. He says, the city is prior by nature to the household and to each of us. Very important statement. The city is prior by nature. Now, he doesn't mean it's prior in time. Obviously, the city arises later in time. But it's logically prior to the household or to individuals. He says, to each of us. And it's not only logically prior, it's morally prior. He goes on and he explains. He says, the whole must of necessity be prior to the part. And this is where he gets into his whole philosophy of teleology. The whole body is destroyed. If the whole body is destroyed, there will not be a foot or a hand. The whole is prior to the part. The city is logically prior to the individual. He says, in fact, the city is both by nature prior to each individual. Well, he says, there is in everyone, each of us, by nature, an impulse to this sort of partnership. That is, the political partnership. Now, what are the implications of this? Well, let's look at one of the implications. Let's look at what he has to say about slavery. This is chapter 5 of the Politics. This is what he writes about slavery. It says, "Those who are as different from other men as the soul from the body or man from beast, they are in this state if their work is the use of the body, are slaves by nature. There are such things as slaves by nature, such persons as slaves by nature. They're also masters by nature. This is how slavery was justified for thousands of years. There are folks, some sort of beings, who are slaves by nature." Aristotle continues, "He is a slave by nature who is capable of belonging to another, which is why he belongs to another, and who participates in reason only to the extent of perceiving it, but does not have it." He participates in reason only to the extent that he recognizes it, but he doesn't have it himself. This is a slave by nature. The other animals, not perceiving reason, obey their passions. Notice the word other again. The other animals, not perceiving reason, obey their passions. Slavery is a natural institution. Some men are naturally masters and some men are naturally slaves. He makes an interesting comment later on in the Politics about women and children in connection with slavery. He says, "There is by nature a ruling and a ruled element, and there is a different virtue in each. That is, of the element having reason and of the irrational element. It is clear that the same thing holds true in other cases," he says. "By nature, most things are ruling and ruled. The free person rules the slave, the male the female, and the man the child in different ways. The parts of the soul are present in all, but they are all present in a different way. The slave is wholly lacking in the deliberative element, that is, reason. The female has it, but it lacks authority. The child has it, but it's incomplete." That's his explanation of the difference between natural slaves, women, and children. In the male, reason is not only present, but it has authority. In the slave, reason is missing. The deliberative element, as he calls it, is missing. In the female, reason is there, but it has no authority. And in the child, reason is there, but it's incomplete. And this is his view of society. Well, let's look at what he has to say about marriage, since that's the first of the partnerships that eventually lead to the political partnership. And you have to turn almost to the end of the Politics for this. Since the political partnership is the most authoritative and the highest partnership, the partnership that includes all the others, the political partnership is the one that controls all the other partnerships, in Aristotle's thought. Consequently, he writes in chapter 16, the legislator should see to it from the beginning that the bodies of those being reared are to become the best possible. So care must be taken in the first place in connection with the union of men and women to determine when and with what quality of persons marital relations with one another ought to be brought about. One should legislate with respect to this partnership with a view to the partners themselves. Here you have the political partnership, the state, controlling who gets married to whom and when. Aristotle goes on and says, in his opinion, the best time for a man and a woman to get married, the woman should be 18, and the man should be 37. And he explains why that's the case. And that should be the law of the state. That's when they get married. Then he gives what the legislator should do with regard to pregnant women. Even pregnant women ought to take care of their bodies, not remaining idle or taking meager sustenance. This is easy for the legislature to do by mandating that they make a trip every day, to worship the goddesses. And then he adds in parentheses, the mind, however, unlike their bodies, may fittingly spend time in more idle fashion. Aristotle has a sense of humor, I guess. Then he talks about the offspring, the children that result from these politically regulated marriages. He says, concerning exposure. Now, do you know what exposure is? It's the practice of the Greeks and the Romans of exposing infants that they didn't want to raise. They would take them into the mountains and leave them there, abandon them. And they didn't want to raise it. He says, concerning exposure and rearing of offspring, when they are born, let there be a law that no deformed child should be raised. By law, let there be a law. He says, no deformed child should be raised. That none should be exposed after they are born on account of the number of offspring. So if you don't do it just because there are too many. Where the arrangement of customs forbids procreation beyond a certain number. A number should indeed be defined for procreation by the legislator, but in cases of births in consequence of intercourse contrary to these, abortion should be induced before perception and life arise. Now, who can tell me what government on earth follows Aristotle's policies? China. Very good. China. They follow Aristotle's prescriptions. Okay, now he continues with his discussion of things after talking about infanticide. He brings up education for those who survive infancy in his state have to be educated. And this is what he says about education. He says, the legislator must therefore make the education of the young his object above all. That's his object above all. Says there is a single end for the city as a whole. See, this is the basis of his whole argument. There's a single purpose, a single good, a single end for the city as a whole. It is evident that education must necessarily be one and the same for all, and that the superintendence of it should be in common and not on a private basis. For common things, the training too should be made common. One ought not even consider that a citizen belongs to himself, but rather that all belong to the city, for each individual is a part of the city. I hope you see the totalitarian implications of what Aristotle writes in the Politics. Then he praises the Lacedaemonians for this. He says they most of all pay serious attention to their children, and they do so in common. Rulers and their natural citizens. There are natural husbands and there are natural wives, natural parents, natural children. It's all natural. We saw the totalitarian implications of this, how he says there's a hierarchy of purposes in society, in the state. You have the lowest is marriage with the purpose of procreation, then you have the household, then you have the village, and finally you have the city, the highest political organization. This theory of the state was adopted by the Roman Church, among others, and they developed what they called the principle of subsidiarity, by which they argued that higher orders in society, higher orders in the state, ought to allow lower orders to fulfill their functions. And some in politics, some conservative Roman Catholic candidates for office say it's this principle of subsidiarity that is reflected in federalism, the federal system of government, and that requires us to recognize, as it were, the rights of local and county and state governments. Unfortunately, they're kidding themselves, because who judges in such a matter as to whether a lower partnership, whether it's the marriage, the household, or the village, is performing properly? Well, obviously, only the higher authority does. It's the political authority, as Aristotle explained, that has the highest authority. and is the judge of all these other partnerships in the state. So the legislator sets the rules for marriage. Women get married at 18, men get married at 37. Who you marry is determined by the law. How many children you have is determined. The fact that you cannot raise a deformed child is determined by law. All of these things are done by the legislator. And this follows from the political theory here of Aristotle. The notion that subsidiarity, as the Roman Catholic Church has developed it, is a check on the power of government is a joke. It's not. It's precisely this subsidiarity where one purpose is subordinated to another one. One partnership is subordinated to another partnership, and they're all subordinated to government, that is the essence of fascism. It's the essence of totalitarianism. There isn't any partnership outside the purview of government. There's no purpose outside the jurisdiction of the state. That's totalitarianism. So we've got two answers to our question so far. One is anarchism, which ends up in lawlessness and violence and destruction. The other is Aristotle, with his natural view of the state, which ends up in totalitarianism. Let's go on to the third non-Christian view, non-Christian answer to these questions, and it's the social contract theory. Now, there are three major figures in social contract theory. Thomas Hobbes, writing in the middle of the 17th century, an Englishman. John Locke, writing at the end of the 17th century, another Englishman. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau, a Frenchman, writing in the 18th century. Those are the three major political philosophers who put forth the social contract theory of government. This is the theory that said government is not natural. We do have to have a government, but it's not a natural thing. It's something that we arrive at by agreement. What's common to all these three theorists is that they teach that there is a state of nature, as they call it, in which there is no government to begin with, in which all men are equal. But to use Locke's phrase, there are inconveniences in the state of nature. Hobbes is more descriptive. He says it's a state of war, this state of nature in which there is no government. But there, whether you call them inconveniences or whether you call them war, everybody gets together at some point and makes an agreement. They're going to form a government. And they're going to delegate to this government their rights. And this is an idea, especially in its Lockean form, that is very prevalent in the history of America. Well, I'm not going to discuss Thomas Hobbes any further than I have because he is so obviously an advocate of absolute government. He wrote a book, published a book in 1651 called Leviathan. He wrote several books, but this is the major one dealing with the government, Leviathan. And he's an advocate of absolute monarchy. The monarch, the king, has unrestricted and absolute power. So in Hobbes's version of the social contract theory, when people surrender their rights to the government through the social contract, they surrender all of them. And the king is absolute. Now we're back again to an absolute government. This is where the social contract theory leads in Hobbes. John Locke doesn't arrive at quite the same position. And I want to read you some paragraphs from Locke's Two Treatises of Government. If you don't have the book, get the book. If you're interested in political philosophy, it's one of the seminal books in the history of the subject. This is the only edition to get, the edition by Peter Laslett of Cambridge University, the foremost Locke scholar of the 20th century. It's a critical edition. He gives a long, extended introduction to the book, lots of history about it, and then lots of footnotes to Locke's two treatises. Very useful book. I don't know what it sells for these days. When I bought mine, it was a dollar and a half. The price is. I'm sure the price is something like $15 now for it. but this is the best edition to get, and I highly recommend Laffitte's edition. Let me read a little bit from what Locke has to say. Describing the state of nature to begin with, this is a very important idea in the social contract theorists, because they say there was originally a condition of society in which there was no government. That's what they call the state of nature. They're trying to explain how government came about. And this is what Locke says. He says, to understand political power right and derive it from its original, we must consider what state all men are naturally in, that is, a state of perfect freedom. That's the state of nature in Locke, a state of perfect freedom to alter their actions and dispose of their possessions and persons as they think fit, within the bounds of the law of nature, without asking leave or depending upon the will of any other man. See, everybody's free and equal. You don't have to ask anybody's consent or anybody's permission to do what you want to do. He refers to it as a state of equality in the next paragraph, and so on. Let me see if I can give you a few more descriptions of it. He quotes the Anglican theologian Hooker, Richard Hooker, as supporting his view. Then he goes on and he describes the state of nature as a state of liberty. Yet it is not a state of license, he says. Man in that state has an uncontrollable liberty to dispose of his person or possession, yet he has not liberty to destroy himself or so much as any creature in his possession, but where some nobler use than its bare preservation calls for it. The state of nature has a law of nature to govern it, which obliges everyone. And reason is that law. Then to justify his appeal to this prescription of suicide, he says you can't commit suicide in the state of nature. He brings in scripture. And this is where Locke gets complicated, because he doesn't stick with his original assumptions all the way through. Whenever it's convenient, he brings in scripture. He says, men being all the workmanship of one omnipotent and infinitely wise maker, all the servants of one sovereign master, sent into the world by his order and about his business, they are his property, whose workmanship they are, made to last during his, not their pleasure. So that's how he justifies his prohibition on suicide, or his prohibition on murder in the state of nature. He appeals to scripture when it's convenient, but in constructing his theory of the state of nature, he doesn't appeal to it at all. So Locke is a somewhat inconsistent political philosopher in that regard. Let's talk about property for a moment, because his theory of property becomes very important in the later development of both economics and political theory. In the section on property, he writes, God has given the world to men in common. Now, this, of course, is echoed by the anarchists in the 19th century. It's also echoed by the Roman Church in their political theory. And he has also given them reason to make use of it to the best advantage. And he repeats this theme over several pages, that everything belongs to mankind in common. He says, nobody has originally a private dominion exclusive of the rest of mankind in anything. Nobody has private property. He calls it dominion. No one has a private dominion exclusive of the rest of mankind in everything. Everything is given in common. Paragraph 27, though the earth and all inferior creatures be common to all men, And this is where he begins his argument, attempting to justify private property. He says, every man has a property in his own person. While the earth is given to men in common, everything you can think of that's on the earth, animals, trees, fields, whatever, each person has a property, a private property in his own person. This nobody has any right to but himself, he said. The labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his. Now, he doesn't argue this, he simply asserts it, that each person has a property in his own person. Whatsoever, then, he removes out of the state of nature and has mixed his labor with, and he has joined to it something that is his own, and thereby makes it his property. This is how he attempts to justify private possessions. You go out and you mix your labor, which is your own, he says. It doesn't belong to anyone else. You mix your labor with something. You till a piece of ground, or you fence it in, or you capture an animal, whatever mixing your labor with it entails. And then because you've mixed something you own with it, that becomes your property. And this is his account of the origin of private property. He says, labor is the unquestionable property of the laborer. So that gives you a right to own something. Now, the difficulty with that theory is this. He's already told us that the earth is given to everyone in common. That is, everyone owns the earth. But he goes on and he denies that you have to ask anyone's consent to mix your labor with something. He anticipates the objection. The objection is, if I don't own anything privately, but only in common, then by what right can I take something out of the commons? And he says, you don't have to ask anyone's permission. And the reason he says you don't have to ask anyone's permission is, if you did, you would die. Well, that's no argument at all. That's no argument at all. He's already established that the earth is owned in common. And he says it repeatedly. So Wilmore Kendall, who was a political theorist in the middle of this century, an American, wrote a book on Locke in which he detailed what he called Locke's latent communism. And that's exactly what it is. Property is owned in common, and there's no way in Locke's theory to get it out of the commons. His theory simply glides over the difficulties and says you mix your labor with it. Well, it's not simply a problem with the nature of property in Locke. He says you have to have unanimous consent. Clark brings this up in his chapter on politics, where he talks about the original social contract and how the contract has to be unanimously agreed to. But of course, there is no government on earth to which everyone has unanimously agreed, so the theory justifies no actual government. It may be a nice theory, but it justifies no actual government and explains no actual government, no existing government. Locke argues that you have to have that unanimous consent, and it's that unanimous consent that justifies majority rule. The legislature in Locke, he distinguishes different functions of government, the legislative function from the executive function, and the legislature in Locke is supreme. And he says so quite clearly. Skipping over a few pages, on the heading is the extent of legislative power. Locke writes, "The first and fundamental positive law of all commonwealths is the establishing of the legislative power as the first and fundamental natural law, which is to govern even the legislative itself, is the preservation of society. And as far as will consist with the public good of every citizen in it." Now, that's an interesting expression there. We're going to preserve society. That's the first law. It's the law of self-preservation. And then, as far as will consist with the public good, every person in it. So what you see here is a growing subordination of the individual again to the common, the collective. And this shows up even in Locke, who is by far the most individualist of the social contract thinkers. Then he goes on and he writes, "This legislative power is not only the supreme power of the commonwealth, but sacred and unalterable in the hands where the community have once placed it." He describes the legislative power, the legislature, as the supreme power in the commonwealth, and he develops that theme for several more pages. Now, he does ameliorate his views, or attempt to ameliorate his views, at various points in his book by bringing in scripture. Locke was the son of Calvinist parents. He was raised in a Calvinist or Reformed home, and that influence on his thinking shows up in the two treatises of government. Unfortunately, it's not enough of an influence to have caused him to write a different book. And he relies on the idea that government arose simply by a social contract. The theorist that Rousseau talks about, that Clark talks about, is Rousseau. Rousseau was a scoundrel. I don't think we could describe John Locke that way, perhaps not even Thomas Hobbes that way. But Rousseau is a scoundrel. Let me tell you what I mean by that. I'll tell you in Rousseau's own words. He had five children and abandoned them all. But notice how he describes it. The way he writes in his Confessions, he wrote an autobiography called Confessions. And the way he describes it, he wants to make himself out more or less to be the victim. Not the children, but he's the victim. He's sort of the father of the, you know, all the victims of the 20th century. Everybody's a victim today. I don't know if they've all read Rousseau or what. He talks about the conclusions. He says Therese, that was his mistress, as Therese became pregnant for the third time, too sincere with myself, too proud in my heart to be willing to belie my principles by my actions, I began to consider the fate of my children and my relationship with their mother by reference to the laws of nature, justice, reason, and religion. If I was mistaken in my conclusions, he says, nothing can be more remarkable than the calm spirit in which I surrendered to them. If I were one of those low-born men, deaf to the gentle voice of nature, a man in whose breast no real feeling of justice and humanity ever arose, this hardness of heart would have been quite easy to explain. But my warm-heartedness, my acute sensibility, the ease with which I formed friendships, the hold they exercised on me, and the cruel wrench when they had to be broken, my innate goodwill toward my fellow men, my burning love for the great, the true, the beautiful, and the just, my horror of evil in every form, my inability to hate, to hurt, or even to wish to. That softening, that sharp and sweet emotion I feel at the sight of all that is virtuous, generous, and lovable, is it possible that all these can ever dwell in the same soul along with depravity, which quite unscrupulously tramples the dearest obligations underfoot? No, I feel and boldly declare it is impossible. Never for a moment in his life could Jean-Jacques have been a man without feelings or compassions, an unnatural father. I may have been mistaken, but I can never be callous. Then he goes on and writes some more. He says, in handing my children over for the state to educate, for lack of means to bring them up myself, by destining them to become workers and peasants instead of adventurers and fortune hunters, I thought I was acting as a citizen and a father, and looked upon myself as a member of Plato's Republic. My third child, therefore, was taken to the foundling hospital like the others, and the next two were disposed of in the same way, for I had five in all. The arrangement seemed so good and sensible and right to me that if I did not boast of it openly, it was solely out of regard for their mother. But I told everyone whom I had told of our relationship. In a word, I made no mystery about my conduct, not only because I would never have been able to conceal anything from my friends, but because I really saw nothing wrong in it. All things considered, I made the best choice for my children, or what I thought was the best. I could have wished, and still do wish, that I had been brought up and nurtured as they have been. It's quite a mentality. He's very self-righteous. Nothing's wrong with abandoning five children. I don't believe that he ever married Therese. And he thinks it's fine. He thinks it's fine. He's a scoundrel. He became famous when he entered an essay competition. So if you ever see advertisements for essay competitions, be sure to enter them. It was a competition, I've forgotten what the exact topic was, but he became famous by writing an essay in which he attacks society. It's almost an anarchist attack on society. And he says, man is born good, man is born free, but everywhere he is in chains. And he attacks society. Society has corrupted the original innocent man. Man is born innocent. He has a good will. And if men appear to be different, it's only because they've been corrupted by society. He attacks directly the Christian notion of total depravity. He thinks that is absurd. He thinks it's false. And he says men are born innocent, they're born free, and it's only the corrupting influence of society that messes them up. I have to read you what Voltaire, who was another Frenchman of about the same period, wrote. Apparently he had read Rousseau's essay, Attacking Society. And if you know anything about Voltaire, he was a very witty man, could be acid in his wit, wasn't a very profound philosopher, but he certainly was witty. And he writes to Voltaire Rousseau in 1755, and he says, I have received your new book, Against the Human Race. I thank you for it. And then he goes on and he writes, he says, never has so much wit been used in an attempt to make us like animals. The desire to walk on all fours seizes one when one reads your work. However, as I lost that habit more than 60 years ago, I unfortunately sense the impossibility of going back to it. And I abandoned that natural gait. You see how sarcastic he is here, because Rousseau is lauding nature and attacking society. He says, I abandoned that natural gait to those who are worthier of it than you or I. Nor can I embark on a search for the savages of Canada, first because the maladies to which I have been condemned make me require a European doctor, secondly because warfare has reached that country and the example of our nations has made the savages almost as wicked as we. I confine myself to being a peaceful savage. Rousseau, of course, had lauded the savages as being uncorrupted by society. Let me see if there's any other thing in here. Then he writes about Rousseau's family. He says, excessive pride and envy have destroyed Jean-Jacques, my illustrious philosopher. That monster, that's the way Voltaire described him, dares speak of education. a man who refused to raise any of his sons and put them all in foundling homes. He abandoned his children and the tramp with whom he made them. He has only failed to write against his tramp as he has written against his friends. I will pity him if they hang him, but out of pure humanity, for personally I only consider him like a dog, or rather like a dog descended from a dog. I do not know whether he is abhorred in Paris as he is by all the upright people of Geneva, and so on and so forth. And then finally he hears that Rousseau has died, and Voltaire writes, Jean-Jacques really did the right thing by dying. Now, Voltaire is no friend of Christianity, of course, but he was no friend of Rousseau either, so it's funny to read his comments about Rousseau. Well, let's look at Rousseau's theory a little bit in his book called On the Social Contract. He begins a chapter on slavery by denying what Aristotle asserted. He says, no individual has natural authority over his fellow man, and since force creates no rights, see, he's eliminated two theories already. Natural theory of authority, or natural theory of the state, and force, agreements remain the basis of all legitimate authority among men. He says, I've eliminated two, there's only three, so all we're left with is agreements. It doesn't apparently enter into the minds of these theorists that there is possibly another answer. So he says this agreement, as Clark explains in that chapter, has to be a unanimous agreement. There has to be a unanimous agreement when everybody comes together in the state of nature. And furthermore, this unanimous agreement makes the collective, the body politic, you might call it, supreme. He says, each of us puts his person and all his power in common under the supreme control of the general will. Here you have again this idea of supreme power, the supreme control of the general will. When you surrender your rights and leave the state of nature, the community that results from this contract, this social contract, owns everything. The surrender of rights is complete. Later on in the book, he writes, the right of each individual to his own piece of land is always subordinate to the community's right to everything, without which there would be neither solidity in the social bond nor real power in the exercise of sovereignty. The community's right to everything is the way he puts it. The general will, which is the expression of the body politic, is infallible. It never is an error. He talks about the general will alone can direct the forces of the state in accordance with the end for which it was instituted, that is, the common good. The general will alone can direct the state toward the common good. The general will, he writes, is always in the right and always tends toward the public utility, but it does not follow that the decisions of the people are always equally correct. A person always wills his own good, but he does not always see it. The people is never corrupted, but it is often deceived. This general will, which directs the state to its proper end and which is always in the right or always infallible, says it must. He says it must have a universal and compelling force in order to move and dispose each part of the state in the manner best suited to the whole. Just as nature gives each man absolute power over all his members, the social pact gives the body politic absolute power over all its members. Here again, you have absolute power. He's the theorist of the French Revolution, to go back to your question, Frank. Rousseau is the theorist of the French Revolution and was responsible for much of what happened back then. He goes on and he writes other things. He talks about force. Let's see here. A citizen owes to the state all the services he can render as soon as the sovereign asks for them. A citizen owes to the state all the services he can render as soon as the sovereign asks for them. He refers to the sovereign power as wholly absolute, wholly sacred, and wholly inviolable. Then he goes on and he specifically attacks Locke's view. He doesn't mention Locke by name, but he specifically attacks Locke's view. He says, it may be asked how private individuals, having no right to dispose of their own lives, see, that's what Locke had argued. He said, you cannot commit suicide, and you cannot murder, so you obviously can't delegate that right to the government. So the government has no right to murder anyone, in Locke's theory. And so Rousseau deals with this issue. He says, it may be asked how private individuals, having no right to dispose of their own lives, can transfer to the sovereign the very right they do not possess. This question appears difficult to resolve only because it is poorly posed. Every man has the right to risk his own life in order to preserve it. Has it ever been said that anyone who throws himself out a window to escape a fire is guilty of suicide? Has such a crime ever even been imputed to someone who perishes in a storm, even if he was fully aware of the danger when he embarked? He says, when you sign the social contract, he says, the citizen is no longer the judge of the perils to which the law wants him to expose himself. And when the prince has said to him, it is expedient for the state that you die, he should die, since it is only on this condition that he has lived in safety up to this time, and since his life is no longer merely a blessing of nature, but a conditional gift of the state. I want to read that again. The citizen is no longer the judge of the perils to which the law wants him to expose himself, and when the prince has said to him, it is expedient for the state that you die, he should die, since it is only on this condition that he has lived in safety up to that time, and since his life is no longer merely a blessing of nature, but a conditional gift of the state. Your life is a conditional gift of the state. oddly enough, he seems to admit later on in the book that in order to set up a state properly, you need divine intervention. He talks about the need for a lawgiver. And if you think back to Israel, ancient Israel, not modern Israel, but ancient Israel, they had a lawgiver, but they did not have a legislature. The laws were given by God, and there wasn't any standing legislature, as it were, that could modify the laws at will, change them willy-nilly. They had a system of judges whose job was to apply the law to specific cases as those cases arose. But there was no legislature. And Rousseau sort of dimly realizes that there's something here to this. He says you have to have a lawgiver, really, to get the state off to a good start. But he's not about to make room for the law of God, of course. How about church and state in Rousseau? Now, in ancient society, of course, as we talked about last night, in the Greece of Aristotle, for example, if you did not worship the gods of Athens, you were executed. Aristotle himself, irony of ironies, fled for his life from Athens. He said, in order to keep Athens from sinning against philosophy twice, he was thinking of Socrates the first time. Socrates was the first sin against philosophy when Athens killed Socrates. Aristotle had to flee for his life in order to prevent that from happening again. This is what Rousseau says. about religion in the state. See if I've got the right reference here. He says, I am mistaken in speaking of a Christian republic. Those two words are mutually exclusive. Christianity preaches nothing but servitude and dependence. Its spirit is too favorable to tyranny. Keep in mind who's writing this. Its spirit is too favorable to tyranny. For tyranny not always to take advantage of it. True Christians are made to be slaves. They know it and are scarcely moved by it. This short life has too little worth in their eyes. Then he goes on and he explains his views. He says, the right which the social pact gives the sovereign over the subjects does not, as I have said, go beyond the limits of public utility. The subjects are not therefore accountable to the sovereign for their opinions, except insofar as these opinions are of importance to the community. Now it is of great importance to the state that each citizen should have a religion that makes him love his duties. But the dogmas of this religion interest neither the state nor its members, except insofar as these dogmas relate to morality and the duties, and so on and so forth. There is, therefore, a purely civil profession of faith, the articles of which are for the sovereign to determine, not precisely as religious dogmas, but as sentiments of sociability, without which it is impossible to be a good citizen or a faithful subject. Without being able to obligate anyone to believe them, the sovereign can banish from the state anyone who does not believe them. It can banish him not for being impious, but for being unsociable, his being incapable of sincerely loving the laws and justice and of sacrificing his life, if need be, for his duty. If, after having publicly acknowledged these same dogmas, someone behaves as though he does not believe them, let his punishment be death. He has committed the greatest of crimes. He has lied before the laws. Now, how many times has Rousseau said, let him die? Well, this is, we're not making much headway here. We've got several answers now to these questions we posed. The first is lawlessness, anarchy, destruction. That's where that secular view brings us to, that non-Christian view, the view of the anarchists themselves. Aristotle then takes us to totalitarianism, in which the political partnership controls all the other partnerships. Now we're talking about the social contract theorists, out of three of whom are clearly totalitarians, Hobbes and Rousseau. The only reason Locke seems to escape it is because he is continually bringing in scripture for things that he cannot justify otherwise. He doesn't start out, though, with scripture, but on an ad hoc basis, sort of as a way to save the theory, he brings in scripture, which he probably remembers from his youth. Well, there's one other non-Christian view. That's the view of Spengler and Oliver Wendell Holmes. And if you'll turn in a Christian view of men and things, let's look at a couple of quotes from those men. I particularly want to call your attention to Oliver Wendell Holmes, since he was a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. On page 73, look at the quote in the margin, the footnote, page 73 of A Christian View of Men and Things. When one thinks coldly, I can see no reason for attributing to man a significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or to a grain of sand. I wonder if cosmically an idea is any more important than the bowels. Look at the quote on page 70 in the footnote. It's about halfway down the page. Truth was the majority vote of the nation that could lick all others.
I am so skeptical as to our knowledge about the goodness or badness of laws that I have no practical criticism except what the crowd wants. So it follows from this that if the crowd wants to kill somebody, then that's right. Now, Holmes might, because of his gentlemanly background, object to a lynch mob. But if the lynch mob were to get more organized and hold a referendum and vote to lynch somebody, he would have no objection whatsoever if they took a poll on it. There is... You can have a lynch mob focus group. There is no reason in this theory, or in Spengler's version of it, which is might makes right, that right grows out of power, for any limitation on the power of government. None whatsoever. So if we believe that a government arose simply out of power, that is, the, as it were, the strongest gang winning, the struggle for power, then we've arrived at absolute government again. Well, this analysis that Clark presents and that I've tried to present, I've added a couple things to it that Clark didn't have in that chapter, such as the discussion of the anarchist directly and the mention of Locke.